For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay. Triumphal entry. Let's read about it. As they approached Jerusalem, they are coming up. They came up from Jericho, and I actually skipped a few verses at the end of chapter 20. There was a healing. They're coming up this. They call it coming up because you're coming from that rift valley down by the Dead Sea, up this winding road, up 2,500 foot of elevation, 3,000 total feet of climb up this road, and then you come up. Finally, come to Bethphage on the Mount of Olives. That's immediately across from Jerusalem. This is right within eyesight now of Jerusalem. Bethphage, Bethany. Okay, it's a mile outside of Jerusalem. Maybe a mile and a half. And so Jesus sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and at once you will find a donkey tied there with her colt by her. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone says anything to you, tell him that the Lord needs them, and he will send them right away." This took place to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet. "Say to the daughter of Zion, see, your king comes to you, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, on the foal of a donkey." Okay, so here they are, untying the donkey and its colt. And the owner comes out and says, "What's my donkey there?" And they say, "The Lord has need of it." And he's like, "Okay." Pretty funny story there. But anyway, so here's this donkey and her colt together. And they bring it out. And this was to fulfill. This passage comes from the book of Zechariah in the Old Testament, chapter 9. And it says that the Messiah, your king, King Messiah is going to come riding to you on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. So just like baby horses are called colts, baby donkeys are also called colts or foals. Disciples went and did as Jesus instructed. They brought the donkey and the colt. They placed their cloaks on them, and Jesus sat on them. Actually, it was on the colt that he sat. But the mother donkey walked along with them. He wasn't sitting on the two of them at once. That's ridiculous. Can't believe NIV is translating it that way. Okay, so they come riding up. A very large crowd shows up. Okay, word had gotten none. It's apparently he spent the night in Bethany, and word has gotten into Jerusalem. He's out there. He's coming. This crowd comes out. There was expectation. People had seen these healings. They had seen these miracles that he had done. Jesus' fame was growing. You know, he had tens of thousands sometimes in these multitudes that would come out to listen to him. And so they hear that he's coming. And here he comes down this road around the Kidron Valley on a donkey, on a colt of a donkey. And the crowd comes out and they spread their cloaks on the road. Others cut branches from the trees and spread those on the road. It's familiar. We know what this is. This is a parousia. This is a coming celebration where this was common in Roman world, where like a king, an emperor, or general who had won a great victory would come to the city and they would have this triumphal entry. It's a celebration, kind of like ticker tape parades that they used to have in New York City. There's no such thing as ticker tape anymore, so I don't even know if they still have them. But, you know, where we had these after World War II, you know, VE and VJ Day. They had ticker tape parades, and the soldiers would go through, and they would shower them with ticker tape, and it was a big celebration. So that's kind of like what this was. And they would come out, and they're laying these things down so that, you know, it's kind of like a gesture, like rolling out the red carpet or something like that. And so we know this custom from historic sources. And yet, this was kind of strange as well. There's some strange aspects here. The crowd that went ahead of him and those that followed shouted, "Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest." And they call him the Son of David. That's a code word. That's, you know, the Son of David is referring to the Messiah. You're calling him the Messiah. When Jesus entered Jerusalem, the whole city was stirred, and they were asking, who is this? The crowds answered, this is Jesus. This is the prophet from Nazareth up in Galilee. Okay, let's add to this account that we just read in Matthew. Let's add Luke's account, which adds a few more details that Matthew didn't put in. Okay, so picking up from where they're coming in, and they're laying their stuff in the road and stuff, and they sang, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. That's quoting Psalm 118, which is a messianic psalm. That is one of the psalms in the Old Testament, the book of Psalms, intended to be sung to the Messiah when he comes. Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, teacher, rebuke your disciples. You hear what they're saying? Calling you the son of David? They're singing Psalm 118? Now, okay, so let's just stop right here. Okay, first of all, let's consider the oddity of this. This is kind of like a triumphal entry, and yet it's really not like a triumphal entry either. In a triumphal entry, the general or the king or whatever comes in a great chariot, a spectacular chariot with jewels and inlaid and gold, and a set of beautiful white horses, you know, and his brilliant, you know, gilded armor and helmet and so forth, and a picture of glory, power, or sometimes riding a great stallion. They would sometimes come on horseback. This triumphal entry is kind of strange because he's riding on the colt of a donkey. Okay, I mean, a lot of people have never ridden on a donkey. I have. I know about donkey riding. Because I used to have these donkeys at this camp I went to, and you could check out a donkey and go riding around on them. They're quite small. Don't confuse a donkey with a mule. Mules are big like horses. Donkeys are really small. And the colt of a donkey would be very small. I mean, his feet are probably dragging on the ground. It's that small. You feel like you're riding a dog if you get on one of the smaller ones. You know, they're really small. And so he's riding on this, and it's like, that is not how you're supposed to be coming in. And, you know, the people, though, are shouting to him and singing these songs about the Messiah on the one hand. And the Pharisees come up and say, you should tell them, you should rebuke them for that. They're calling you the Messiah. Now, if you've been studying Matthew with us, you've seen that several places where Jesus healed someone. And he said, tell no one. Because they were like, you're the son of David. You must be the one. You're the promised one. And he's tell no one about him. Peter said, you are the Christ, the son of the living God. And he says, tell no one. When they came down from the mountain of transfiguration, don't tell anyone about this. Don't tell anyone what you see. He was always with all the secrecy and stuff. He would always tell people. He's trying to keep it down. Today, on this occasion, his position changes. He says, I tell you, he replied, if they kept quiet, the stones would cry out. It's like, okay, the blanket's being thrown back, and now Jesus is just like, up in your face. Boom, deal with it. The Psalm, yeah, 118, verse 26. Jesus, by refusing to hush his disciples, is basically claiming that he deserved to be hailed as the Messiah. And he's really giving now the leadership an ultimatum. Either they are going to have to accept that this is who he is, or they're going to have to come against him, and he's basically ready for a confrontation. This is the reason he always hushed people before when they would say it. He knew that if this got out, that this guy is saying that he's the Messiah, it would have brought about a reaction, and he would have been put to death prematurely. Now, he knew it was coming to that. He told them. We just read that he told them the Son of Man's going to go down and be persecuted and punished and put to death, right? So he knew that was coming. But he didn't want to, he says, my hour has not yet come. So that's why he would try to keep it down, so that he wasn't being put to death prematurely before he got his message out. That's all changed now. He knows this is it. And so he's right up in their face with this is so true that if these people weren't saying it, the rocks would cry out. So, a parousia, and yet a strange parousia, because instead of the reigning, powerful, majestic king coming in, this is this, you know, guy riding on this little donkey. And so the ironies here kind of start to pile up. This is not a normal king. This is the king who serves. This is the king who has come. You know, we'll see him later this week. He's down, takes off his clothes, and except for a loincloth, and is down washing his disciples' feet. You know, stuff like that. He's not like a normal king. The world hasn't seen a king like this. Kings are supposed to be glorious. They're supposed to be awe-inspiring. And this is just this real dumpy little scene coming up. And yet, it's straight out of the scriptures. It's in the Old Testament. Also, we find that Jesus should be, you know, it's like, well, finally, looks like thousands of people out here, they're lying things on the road. It looks like finally they understand. And so, yeah, this would be a great day. You know what it would be like to be praised by that many people, to be acknowledged? But look at Jesus' response. As he approached Jerusalem, he saw the city, he wept over it. And so as we bring the lens in on Jesus, he's got tears running down his face. He said, if you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it's hidden from your eyes. The days are going to come when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you. They're going to hem you in on every side. He's saying this to the city. They'll dash you to the ground, you and your children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. Jesus knows, basically, he wasn't taken in by the acclamation that was going on out here. He knew that within a matter of a few days, these same people would be crying out, crucify, crucify, when he disappointed their expectations of what a Messiah should be like, of what a king should be like. And he wasn't coming to give them what they expected. So he knew that this whole, you know, glorification thing was very superficial, that they really had not grasped who he was at all, and that they would turn against him just like that, so that it was their allegiance that was being proclaimed out here was very superficial. And it made him weep, because he knew that they were completely missing everything, and that what lay ahead for Jerusalem was dreadful. Everything he says here actually came to pass. This, your enemies are going to surround you and hem you in on every side. This all came to pass within a few years after this event. The Jews rose up in revolt against Rome. Not a good idea. And the Romans sent an army. They besieged Jerusalem. And eventually breached it. The rebels fought from within. It was an awful, you know, gory, old, ancient way type battle, where super savage, super brutal people slaughtered in the many of thousands of people. Josephus says that 80,000 Jews were sold as slaves. And so this was really handled Roman style, where they not only wanted to beat you, but they wanted everyone to remember this whole notion that you're going to rise up against Rome is not a good idea. And this is what happens. when you think that you're going to rise up against our authority. So they really make a point of it, and they stripped this city of people. They were either dead or sold as slaves. The temple, which stood there, this a spectacular temple, because Herod had spent decades, building up around the temple grounds there, was burned, and the fires were so intense that a lot of the fixtures, which were gold, melted. And the Roman soldiers, according to Josephus, came to believe that that gold had oozed into the cracks in the stone. And so as a result, they tore down the entire thing stone by stone looking for this gold. And what Jesus said, they will not leave one stone on another, literally came to pass today. You can still go to Jerusalem. The only thing that's left there, of course, the Dome of the Rock is on there now, on this Temple Mount. The platform that used to house the temple is still there, but the rocks for the temple, you can also see they're lying down, pushed off the side of this Temple Mount in piles around the bottom. And so this fate came to pass. Well, the reason he says you did not recognize the time of your visitation. He expected them to realize what was happening here. You can tell that he's holding them responsible. You should have recognized the time of your visitation. And one of the reasons for holding this is that this specific time had been predicted in advance, and they knew that. They had those scriptures, they read them, and they knew that the Messiah was supposed to be coming at about this time. And I'd like to look at that tonight. We haven't looked at this for a while. It's one of my favorites. A passage in the Old Testament, which specifies that this event we're reading about, this triumphal entry of Jesus, that it would happen, and that it would happen exactly at this particular time. Let's look at the first prophecy. There's two prophecies involved here. The first comes from Zechariah, and Matthew says this took place to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on the colt, the foal of a donkey. Okay, so that's referring to this event. Your king is coming. You're just and endowed with salvation. In other words, he's got the ability to save. Yet he's not like most kings. He's going to be sitting on the foal, the colt of a donkey. And people who read this, as Jews did, in synagogue, they read these scriptures all the time. They knew them perfectly, knew them very well, would recognize that's it. He's coming up. He's riding on the colt of the donkey. Of course, as modern people, we can read both of these, the prophecy in Zechariah written around 450 to 500 B.C., and we can read about the fulfillment of that prophecy here in Matthew 21. And you can see certain problems with what we're reading, which is, namely, okay, Jesus had read that too, right? So if he's a guy who wants to be like, okay, he's volunteering to be the Messiah, then it would be natural for him to be like, okay, we're going to have to ride in Jerusalem on a donkey colt at some point. And so you can set this up and basically fulfill this prophecy on purpose. And so it's really not that remarkable if you look at it for that way. All you got to do is get a colt of a donkey and ride in Jerusalem on it, and you're like, see, this is what it predicted. So some prophecies are this way. They could have been predicted. They could have been fulfilled intentionally. But the other one that we want to look at is not that way. This other one is the one, predictions without this limitation of being self-predictable. And that, the one we want to focus on here for a few minutes, I'm going to give you the quickie version, is the time of your visitation, which is predicted in the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. Here's the prediction. Comes in chapter 9, 24 of Daniel. We're cutting to the chase here, but Daniel has been praying to God for why have our people been exiled for 70 years, and he's been studying the other Old Testament books that predicted this would happen. He's writing this from Babylon, which has now been taken over by the Persians, but he's over in that area of the city of Babylon, and an angel comes and gives him this announcement. 77s are decreed for your people and your holy city to do a number of things: to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. All right. Again, taking the short path here, that basically means to finish up everything there is to do and to bring in everlasting life. Some of this has still not happened, even in our day. But he's saying your people have been sent out of their country for 70 years, and they're going to be sent back and given 70 more sevens. And we will find that the sevens here refer to sevens of years, the sabbatical year. We can prove that. The last two verses in 2 Chronicles states it explicitly, that this is why the 70-year sentence was given, so that the land of Israel could enjoy its Sabbath years, all the days that Israel was in their enemy's territory. They had Sabbaths of days and Sabbaths of years. And this is referring to Sabbaths of years. 70 sevens of years. That's 490 years. He says, that's how long you guys have to finish all of the work that the Jewish people have to do. And here's how it breaks down. First, from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. This is the part we're mainly going to concern ourselves with tonight. Now, remember, Jerusalem is laying in ruins as this is given to him. And he says there's going to be a decree to rebuild Jerusalem. And you can actually get the syntax here if you just focus on these words: from the issuing of a decree until the Messiah, the ruler, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. From this until that is going to be X. So we could write a little diagram up. From the issuing of a decree to rebuild Jerusalem. Okay, that hasn't happened yet when Daniel gets this message. That's still in the future. He says, when that decree comes out, from then until the coming of Messiah will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. That's just a diagram of that sentence. That's what it says. And so we have a time span here. Total of 69 of the sevens, all but one of them is used up. And we can simply do the math. 7 times 7 is 49 years. 62 times 7 would be 434 years. So we could add 434, and it's 483 years is how much is between these two events. Now we have to convert their years, their lunar years, into modern years, which is not hard to do. Their years were 360 days. Ours are 365 days, so you just take the 483 times 360. That makes 173,880 days. Divide that by 365 days, and so in our years, that would be 476 years, with a small remainder. And so we can plug that in, their 483 years under the lunar calendar, same as 476 under our solar calendar. They didn't know how long a year was back then. That wasn't discovered until around 1000 AD under the Gregorian calendar that we have. Ancient people, they knew approximately how long the year was, but They had to kind of insert months now and then to make things come out right. So we're ahead on that score. We're using our calendar, though, to resolve this. Therefore, we're using our years, not their years. 476 years. Okay, so from the issuing of a decree to rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah will be 476 years. That's what it says. If we could only date this beginning of this prediction, then we would know exactly when the fulfillment of the prediction of the prediction comes. So happens that we have a date for this decree. We know exactly when this decree, it did come out. It was after Daniel's time it came out. And it came out as described in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 1 through 8. It was issued by Artaxerxes the First. He says it was in the 20th year of in the month of Nisan, in Artaxerxes' 20th year. We know that Artaxerxes, well-known emperor of the Persian Empire, this is the Encyclopedia Britannica here, says, along, you can look it up in Wikipedia if you'd prefer, you get exactly the same numbers, 465 and 425 BC is what were the years of his reign. Remembering that numbers go downward in BC instead of upward, right? The 20th year of his reign, starting in 465, would be 445 BC. And so 445, Artaxerxes began the 20th year of his reign. But Nehemiah says the decree was given in the month of Nisan. That's in the spring. His reign began in the fall. So his 20th year started in the fall 445 and went till the fall 444. The decree was in the spring 444 BC. And we have the date for the issuing of this decree to rebuild Jerusalem. There's your date right there. Oh, well, we can probably already start to sense this is... Okay, let's see now. Let's keep doing the math then. We know 400... Let's take a negative 444 to stand for BC and add 476 years to that, and we get a positive 32. We're going to add one more year to that. Because... this is a calendar, not a number line. And in the calendars, there is no position for zero. There's no year zero. It's one BC ends, one AD begins the next day. And therefore, you wind up one year off if you add or subtract across that, and you have to correct it with a year. The correct solution to this problem is 33 AD, and that, according to this passage, is the date when Messiah, the prince, the ruler, will come. People have actually worked this out right down to the day. There is a way to work this out down to the very day. And when they do that, they come up with the day that for this event that we're reading about, the triumphal entry of Jesus into Jerusalem. I don't know whether the day thing, I don't know how, whether I believe in that or not. It depends on a couple of assumptions, like that we're starting at Nisan, the first of Nisan, as opposed to some other day in Nisan. It doesn't really say that.
So I just leave it as years. It's close enough. This is the date. This is the date for the event that we read about in that passage in Matthew 21 tonight. It happened in 33 AD. That's consensus today. And we have something really astonishing here. Think about this. This is really not normal. We're looking here at a passage which accurately predicts the date of the coming of Christ over 500 years in advance. This book was well known to the Jewish people. You know, and... you can't do that. You know, even secular thinkers admit that Jesus Christ is probably the most influential figure in human history. I heard that on the History Channel. And you know, if they're saying it, it's got to be pretty freaking authoritative there. And they're certainly not believers in Christ at all. But they, you know, that, I mean, what would your argument be? Who else would you put forward as having affected history more than this man? And here we're saying that the date where he presents himself as the king and also went to the cross a few days later is 33 AD. When I heard this taught as a young Christian, I was plagued with doubt all the time. I was a believer. I had become a believer, but I used to doubt the Bible a lot. You know, I'd read about miracles. I'd read about different things, and I'd be like, oh, man, God, gave me a, you know, acid stomach, because I'd just be like, I don't know if I believe it. I went and heard this passage taught, and it totally blew my mind, because I was reading the text of Daniel. I read the other text of the Nehemiah, the other texts involved and stuff, and it was saying, it did say what they, you know, you could read it right there. I think the whole thing is very persuasive. There's much more detail that could be given. We've definitely covered it quickly. But then I started thinking, well, how do we know that Christians didn't slip that in there? They could have gone back and fiddled with Daniel a little bit and some of those numbers. And then, you know, have it come out that, see, Jesus is the man. And so they're kind of validating themselves. I didn't know too much at the time. I later found out that's not possible. That we have pre-Christian copies, fragments, sections of Daniel, including this chapter, chapter 9. Commentaries on Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls that predate Jesus by 150 years. Daniel is in the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Hebrew Old Testament, which was translated in around 180 BC. How did it get in that translation of the scriptures if it was, and it has this passage in it? It's impossible. Nobody argues, even those who are absolutely against everything the Bible teaches, nobody accepts that Daniel is after Christ. It has to be long before Christ that it was written. Then I thought to myself, maybe it's not that Daniel was faked, but rather that the fulfillment was faked. Like, okay, Jesus could have, you know, done the math, and then they're like, this is it, this is the year. So let's go, let's get the colt, and then they fulfill it just like they did with Zechariah. We'll fulfill Zechariah and Daniel. Or maybe Jesus wasn't even in on it. Maybe it was his followers who, you know, later were like, they did the math and thought and said, yeah, and then it was 33. That's when this happened. That didn't happen either. Couldn't have. Not possible. Two good reasons why. First of all, they didn't know the year. That knowledge, we have the knowledge. We can date Artaxerxes' 20th year to the year. They could not. They had not kept. They didn't have the Western obsession with minutes, seconds, and years and calendars that we do. They didn't keep those kind of records. They knew that it was about the time. I knew that it was close to the time. According to the Jewish scholar and historian Josephus, he said people in Israel knew that Daniel's prediction was at hand and that the Messiah should be coming. And he thought that it referred to an event in 70 AD. He's off by a good, you know, 37 years. That's the closest they could come. But they knew it was sometime around this time that has been. It's been 470 some years. But they could not date it to the year like we can today. Secondly, even more important, the New Testament never says that Jesus died in 33. That's us that say that. All they say are various chronological notations, such as the fact that it happened under Tiberius Caesar, such as the fact that when Jesus was born, Quirinius was governor of Syria, such as the fact that Herod the Great tried to put Jesus to death when he was a baby, and that Herod the Great died in 4 BC, that Jesus was about 30 years of old age when he started his ministry, that during the first year of his ministry, they said, "We have been working on this temple for 46 years, and you're going to raise it up in 3 days. And we know when they started work on the temple. And so you start to assemble all of these. There's about a dozen key chronological notations, which all can be laid over each other, and the X's all come down on one date, 33 AD in the spring. And the New Testament never says what day year it was, but modern scholars are able to accurately fix that date of 33. To fake this, then, the writers of the New Testament would have to anticipate how future scholars will determine the dates of events and write it accordingly. I mean, it's absolutely unthinkable. It's preposterous. Not possible. Can't do that. And so what are we looking at here? We're looking at a text that defies explanation. We wouldn't even need the New Testament. If the New Testament had never been written, we would still know that this came true from secular, non-biblical sources. For example, Tacitus, that's a Roman historian. In the Annals 1544, he says, this is about the persecution of Christians by Nero after the burning of the city of Rome. He says, "Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace." Okay, Tacitus is not a Christian, in case you can't tell. And in this article, he is talking about the Christians, you know, deserve to die, but not with the cruelty that Nero inflicted, because that actually turned people sympathetic to them. Anyway, he goes on, explains. He says, "Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty." That's a euphemism for the cross. That's crucifixion. Okay, he suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius. That's the emperor, Tiberius, at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilatus. That's him, Pontius Pilate. And the most mischievous superstition, thus checked at the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Okay. Tacitus's job, his career, was as a record keeper in the Roman archives in Rome. He had direct access to Roman historical records. And it was using this that he wrote his lengthy history of first century Rome. Tiberius was a Roman emperor. He died in 37 AD. It had to happen before that. Pilate, the arrow points to Pontius Pilatus, was a procurator from AD 26 till 36. So it had to fall within those years. So again, here, without the Bible, you can forget about the Bible and you would still see. Look up Artaxerxes I of Persia in any source you want, any historical source. It will not only give those years for him, but it will also say he's the one that released the Jews to go back and rebuild Jerusalem. And that is not debated by any scholars. That is agreed by one and all. The beginning point and the ending point are both admitted, both by people that support the Bible and those who oppose it. They do attack the prophecy on other grounds, but not on those. And so I think we have something that really deserves some careful thought here. How do you explain something like this? That's not an accident. Come on. 5-6 centuries? And you're gonna specify to the very year the coming of the most influential man in the history of the world? How likely is that? And if it's not an accident, if it's not a coincidence, then what is it? We start to realize we have something supernatural before us here. God himself set forth predictive prophecy as his chosen means of validating the scriptures. In the book of Isaiah, he says, you know, you guys are worshiping idols. He says, that's a joke. Let's see one of them tell us what's going to happen in the future. They can't do it. He says, I'll tell you what's going to happen in the future, and that is my mark. I'm the only one that you know, because God is an omniscient being. He knows the future and the past, both. He knows everything. And so he's like, I'm going to do something that nobody can do but me. And that way you'll know this is I'm the real God, the true God. He says, I am God and there is no other. There is no other. Only me. And so we have something that is absolutely unique here. No other examples, no other founder of any world religion has anything like this that he can point to. We saw when Jesus was coming up the road, the Pharisees stopped him and said, you should rebuke your disciples for saying this. They're calling you the Messiah. And Jesus said, to the contrary, if these are silent, the rocks would cry out. That's a bold claim. Jesus is saying, I am the Messiah. I deserve this. And in the Jewish context, to say that you're the Messiah means that, you know, you're saying you're the one who's going to rule the world forever. Messiah is a supernatural divine character. It says, unto us a child is born, a son is given, and his name will be Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, Mighty God. This is in Isaiah chapter 9 in the Old Testament. For Jesus to say, I am the Messiah, is an incredible claim, which signals sheer insanity, complete insanity, or the most bizarre and sinister kind of liar, or else he actually is. I mean, your choices really aren't that many here. When you lay down the claim next to the verification that he refers to, when he talks about recognizing the time of your visitation, I think it tips the scales. And we start to realize there's a reason here to believe that he actually was who he said. Backed up his claims by a unique system of verification prepared in advance by God, centuries in advance, copied widely, known in a worldwide way, and impossible to deny, impossible to explain. So we have something very powerful here. Jesus is completely unique. We can look at any other claimed Messiah, holy man, wise man that has launched some faith. None of them have anything like this to back them up. Only Jesus Christ. Where are the other examples like this? I've searched. I've taken a real interest in this. I've done a lot of research because I've heard rumors that other religions have predictions too. It's not true. Do the reading yourself. Nothing like this exists. This is absolutely unique. Well, that day, as Jesus came up, as we saw, he was weeping because he knew that this had all just sailed right over the heads of the people there. They did not really get it. They thought he was going to be the kind of Messiah that they wanted. And what they wanted was somebody that would drive the Romans out and give them back their country, give them political power. In the same way, then, today, we are not free to make up a Messiah of our own making. Our choice is either to recognize the one true Messiah that God actually sent and to agree to follow him, to agree to accept his gift that he's brought for us, or not. I'd like to call your attention to a passage in the Gospel of John, chapter 7, verse 17, because Jesus in that speaking, this is on a different occasion, but applies. Speaking in that occasion, said people were questioning whether he was like, BS, like he was making this up, like he was a faker. And he said this, "If anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own." The promise here is really that anybody who is honestly wants to know, is this real? Can I know God through Jesus Christ, through the mediation of Christ? Is Jesus who he said he was? Is he the Son of God? Is he the one that went to his death to make things right between me and God, to pay my penalty, to make it so I can avoid the judgment of God? If that's true, I want to know it. And he says, all you have to do is let God know that you're willing to follow him. You know, the question is, if God showed you, Jesus really is my son, yes, this is all true, then what? Some people might be like, oh, well, cool, but I'm not ready to change. You know, it's like I'm curious, but not because I want to do anything about it. And Jesus is saying that's not good enough. He says, you have to come to God and say, I am willing to do your will. I'm willing to follow. You show me whether Jesus is real, and I will follow him. And if you do that, he says, then God will answer that prayer. He will show you kind of the rest of the story. You will actually experience the presence of God in your life. And in addition to this external evidence that he set us up with to kind of show us, this looks like it might be true, there will be an internal event where you actually have a personal encounter with God. God will come and meet you in a personal way. And at that point, faith has a new basis, which is that I'm actually experiencing God now. I know he's with me, and it's very powerful. I've compared it to finding the peanut butter when you come into the kitchen. You look at the cupboards. You can't remember where you put it. Probably wouldn't be in with the glasses. I don't think I would have put it on with the pots and pans or over there. It's probably in this cupboard right here. That's usually where those things are put. You're not sure whether it's there or not. How much evidence does you need to walk over and open the door and see if the peanut butter's there? That's what Jesus is calling for you to do right here. You have some evidence that it's in this cupboard. We just looked at some evidence that's pretty daggone solid. Daniel 9. That's enough evidence right there to go over and open the door and tell God, if the peanut butter's in this cupboard, I need to see that. And he says, I'll show it to you. And you can come to know Christ. You can come to have a personal encounter with God. This would be the life-changing night of your life. This would be the biggest night of your life, the night that you met God in a personal way. I'm not talking about joining a church. I'm talking about having God come and reveal himself to you personally. Awesome. Wonderful. Do it. No good reason not to ask God to show you the rest of the evidence. You could do that right in your seat tonight when we pray. And he would answer you because he's eager to get together with you. Well, let's draw the line there for tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.